Michael Crichton's novel, Jurassic Park, was an adventure 65 million years in the making. Before it was even released, Universal Pictures and Steven Spielberg acquired the rights to produce a state-of-the-art film adaptation. Its premiere in 1993 became a massive success, spawning several sequels, theme park attractions, live experiences, merchandise, and interactive games. One of these games was Trespasser, The Lost World, Jurassic Park. Released in 1998, this early PC experience was advertised as the evolution of first-person 3D gaming. You played as Anne, voiced by Minnie Driver, a woman who just wanted to go on a vacation to escape from the drama of her life. Unfortunately, Anne got more than she bargained for when her plane crash lands on Isla Sorna, also known as Site B, the abandoned island that was once used by billionaire John Parker Hammond to experiment with the extraordinary science used to recreate extinct dinosaurs. His success becomes Anne's folly, as she must traverse through the island's dinosaur-infested ruins alone to find any hope of rescue. Her only company are Hammond's memoirs, voiced by Lord Richard Attenborough, that are recalled as the island's myth becomes a reality. Seamus Blackley produced and programmed Trespasser, introducing realistic environments, physics, and artificial intelligence that were ahead of its time for the gaming industry. Unfortunately, release dates and budgets were pushed, cutting off the game from reaching its intended potential. This led to an incomplete experience when it was released, ridden with technical bugs and an engine that ran sluggish on the lackluster 90s graphic cards. It became a critical and commercial flop, despite a dedicated fan base that was mesmerized with what the game still achieved and went on to inspire. Thankfully, Seamus made a massive comeback in 2001 when he created Microsoft's Xbox gaming system. To this day, it is the only true rival against Sony's PlayStation, spawning many classic games, including the Halo series. Then, a decade later, Seamus had the unexpected chance to revisit what he had explored with Trespasser. He was tasked to make a gaming sequel to the first three Jurassic Park films. It led to the creation of concept art, detailed documents, and even a fully completed pitch trailer that was shown to executives. Sadly, the game never got made, but its remains were not left to fossilize. Join me now in a detailed, eye-opening conversation with Seamus Blackley as we explore the trials of Trespasser and the unmade Jurassic Park game, whose life found a way.
My name is John Parker Hammond. I was born on March 14th, 1928. What follows is a record of certain events in which I took part between the years 1980 and 1997 on an island I will call Site B. Site B was not to be a theme park, but a research station. This was where we did the real work. By 1989, International Genetic Technologies had succeeded in their design to genetically recreate the dinosaurs. It was an unprecedented accomplishment, the pinnacle of 20th century science, a work to rank with the achievements of Galileo or Einstein. But it was not all so easy or so simple as it appeared. And seldom hears the true history of such events. What happened at the place where the world changed? How it began? What were the reasons? What was the cost?
Seamus, you created the game Trespasser, which was released back in 1998. And even though it didn't do so well, it was really beloved by, you know, a group of fans that loved it so much that they created like their own fan site for it that is still around today, tinkering with it and making it playable on modern systems and trying to restore to what the game was intended to be.
Well, it's good somebody made it playable on modern systems.
So how did Trespasser start for you? Like how did you get involved in the creation of the game Trespasser, The Lost World, Jurassic Park?
I had just shipped another game which was very successful, and in a pattern that I now know pretty well, but I think was confusing to me when I was young, and I think it's confusing to a lot of people. We had shipped a really successful game that made a lot of money, and so therefore the way that the investors thought about that was, oh man, we better change everything now, which is hilarious, but it's a pattern that human beings have. And, you know, they changed everything and then Looking Glass went out of business. And, you know, fortunately, System Shock then sort of resurrected as BioShock. But, you know, I had a lot of ambitions to do another game in as a sequel to that very successful game, and was told that I now had to do what the investors wanted me to do, which was hilarious on the face of it. And now, as a more senior guy who manages people, it pisses me off, because obviously if a group of young people have made something extraordinary, the right business decision is to let them do it again. But most, I guess, you know, investment type people and senior management type people tend to make the opposite decision. And part of it has to do with discomfort with, like, you know, young, you know, crazy, undisciplined seeming people. Part of it was at the time that video games were very new. And so these investors didn't really understand what the hell was going on with video games. So they thought of it as software, and they saw these people, and they didn't look like people at IBM, so therefore they needed to bring in IBM managers or something like that. So it was this crazy thing. And I ended up leaving this company at the pinnacle of success. And I took a job at DreamWorks, and I showed up, and they're like, hey, this is Steven Spielberg. You know, he's, you know, like your boss. And like, we're going to have this division, and we're going to make games. And I had all this physics technology and game design technology that I had been working on with the games at Looking Glass that involved emergent behavior and physically modeled systems and 3D rendering and things that are really common now, but there were very few sort of people who could, like, you know, incant this kind of magic at that time. And it was very hard to do because the systems were so slow, and I really wanted to push it forward. And it came to pass at DreamWorks that, you know, no matter what a hotshot weirdo I was, in order to get funded to make something where I could push those ideas of emergent behavior and, you know, autonomous locomoting characters and all sorts of stuff we could talk about, I really had to put it into some kind of property. And Jurassic Park was the property it landed in. And so, you know, I hired some guys from Looking Glass, also Grossman, some programmers, and tried to carry on at this new place in Hollywood with all these movie people around in the way that I had been carrying on in Cambridge, Massachusetts with a bunch of Harvard and MIT guys. And it wasn't the same. So it didn't work out the same, and I had a lot to learn. But that's how Trespasser came to be. It was a compromise I had to make to exist in this Jurassic Park universe, which, of course, I came to really love. But we had to make this game there. And Furthermore, you know, the people who were running DreamWorks and who were running the part of DreamWorks that I worked for weren't games people. They didn't understand about games. And so in addition to the fact that I was this lunatic and had hired this merry band of other lunatics, that today in our modern world, you would look at that trespasser team and you'd say, this is a hot shit team. These guys are making a lot of money. But in the mid 90s, still we hadn't turned the corner. And a lot of sort of professional people would look at a team like that and think, this is what a bunch of misfits. It's going to be a disaster, which is what they thought. And so I was kind of battling the problem of building something genuinely new, which was a sort of open physics driven world with puzzles that were new and narrative structure that was new, which is hard enough. But I also had a second front that, you know, nobody saw, but I think is probably clear now, of battling management. And there are a million stories like this now. But again, back then, this is like one of the first times somebody had to try to do this. And I was like 27 or 28 or something. I'm not sure I was toilet trained yet, you know, and I'm battling this thing. And I've got guys like Jeffrey Katzenberg screaming at me that it has to ship now, because, you know, of finances or something. And the thing with movie people is that, you know, if you rush a movie, and it's not really done, but you release it, it doesn't like crash the theater. Right? So like, and they didn't understand that. And so I did my best and it literally almost killed me. I was absolutely suicidal. I should have been calling suicide hotlines. You know, it was really bad and we got it done. And my prize was that I was told I no longer had a job. And so it was a dark time. I thought my entire career had been destroyed by this. And I knew, well, and also I felt really bad about leading this group of people who I loved into this hell. And so I knew that we were trying to do something great. And I knew that we were pretty close. And if we had been at a real game company, or if we had had, you know, sort of more understanding or experienced management, we probably would have finished it. But the management at the time, it was all movie people. It was a guy from the special effects world. And, you know, at that time, there were a lot of people who had, like, you know, been around computer graphics who thought that made them understand games, which I think we now understand is ludicrous. But back then, this was a serious thing. And, you know, when you're 27 and trying to explain to a guy who's won, you know, Academy Awards for special effects that he's wrong, it doesn't work so well, right? So that was me. And it was also, you know, there are other things really stacked against Trespasser. One of them was that the first ever 3D cards came out around the time we released. And we had a renderer that was drawing the outside. And so it used this deferred rendering technique to draw tons of trees and stuff. And on a fast machine, it was really cool. But the first 3D cards were garbage. And we now know that. But at the time, they were so hyped. Everybody thought if you put a 3D card in your system, it would magically make every game better. And of course, those 3D cards were designed to draw Doom because that was the most popular game at the time. So they were optimized for like low polygon count indoor areas. And so when you'd run Trespass with these cards, it looked much worse. And so therefore, Trespasser must be bad. And so that was bad. And it was also the very dawn of internet games journalism. It was when right around the time Trespasser releases, when we went from Computer Gaming World and Nintendo Power, et cetera, to Blues News and Old Man Murray and all these sites. And they were fan driven and, you know, maybe not as well informed about game development and super mean. And so I got death threats. I had shit mailed to my house. It was fucking dark. It was really fucking dark. So that was a horrible, horrible dark period of my life. And I am quite surprised it came out of it alive, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, that's understandable given your circumstance. And that's what just makes me kind of angry about, I remember, you know, the scathing like reviews of the game at the time, like they have no idea what happened, you know, behind the scenes with you guys trying to get this game made. And they're just kind of putting the salt in the wound. And I'm sure, you know, whoever at Universal, I mean, at DreamWorks saw that, you know, probably, you know, took it to heart too. And it's just like,
oh, well, the guys running DreamWorks didn't know anything about games or play games. And so, you know, the metrics that they used to understand were different from ours. It's hard. And the other thing about receiving that kind of criticism, especially in the case of a game like Trespasser, where you're really trying, I was trying really hard to bring something good into the world, to bring new stuff into the world that was really cool. And, you know, feeling incredibly punished for it was not ideal. And, you know, a lot of those reviewers just, you know, especially because it was very undisciplined at that time. Not to say that games journalism is super disciplined pursuit, but, you know, it's professional now online, and online games journalism in 1998 was not. And it was terrible. You know, it was like, do you think we were trying to fuck up? Do you think we're trying to fail? Do you think we're stupid? It's just really tough. And sometimes when I remember that, it's really hard and emotional for me because it was so dark. And I also felt so bad and guilty and responsible for leading the team there. I didn't feel at all bad for the management because they were not helpful. But the team deserved better. And I failed to protect them, but I learned a lot. I learned an awful lot. And I have since seen many of the journalists who wrote those articles get into game development, because a lot of game journalists want to become developers. And seeing them receive their own reviews has been, you know, fun to watch, frankly, because I've seen them grow. You learn. It's easy to lob stones. Super easy. It's really hard to do something new. And I think one of the things about Trespasser that we're all very lucky to have done is we did, in fact, create a bunch of new stuff. And I think that's why it's endured with the fans. And also, look, some of the greatest things, some of the greatest compliments that I actually took to heart in my life have come from other game developers, some really famous game developers who have said that they're trying to follow in the footsteps of Trespasser. And that really means something to me, because that's what we were trying.
I think it was widely publicized, at least at a certain point, that the game Half-Life, you know, was inspired by your game, if I'm correct. And that game obviously, you know, was huge and went on to much success. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's a huge compliment to your game that they've publicly said that they were inspired by you. So that's,
yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's great to hear later on, but the PTSD you get from an experience like that is hard to get over.
No, I mean, I can only imagine.
I can complain for myself, but, you know, really it's about, you know, the guys on the team who didn't deserve that. You know, brilliant guys, Mark Langerak and Terry and Austin Grossman. I mean, these are guys who have gone on to great careers doing other things because they're brilliant, and they did not deserve that mark on their record. And it's my fault.
It is painful to see the team suffer, kind of like with movies too. It's like, you know, most people don't plan to make a bad movie either. And it takes thousands of people to make a movie. So it's just like, you know, people have to remember that usually people are trying to do the best they can. And it's just unfortunate sometimes circumstances like the one that you and your team were in happened thanks to factors, you know, largely beyond your control, I'd imagine.
It's very human. I mean, you know, human beings, and this is true in every aspect of human life. When you look at other people, their lives seem obvious and clear to you. and you feel authorized somehow to judge them or make comments about what they're doing, because it seems so easy. But if somebody makes a comment about your life, your immediate reaction is to say, no, you don't understand. It's very complicated. My life is very hard. And everyone feels this way. So it's like, wake up to the fact that everybody has a complicated time and a hard time doing what they do, and have some respect. And that was a big, that was a lesson that, you know, I needed to learn, because to be totally frank, you know, I had gone from being, you know, doing high energy physics, these very difficult things, and being good at it, and, you know, being really good amongst a group of, you know, super rarefied intellects, and then going to Looking Glass, which is a group of super rarefied intellects, and working on a game and then becoming a project leader and then having it be a big hit. And so I was not expecting to fail. And the universe had a lesson for me to learn, and I learned it.
If I can at least hopefully brighten your mood a little bit about the past. well, I mean, I was I'm going to be honest. I'm actually not really a huge gamer. And when I was a kid, the most impressive game to me at the time that I was playing was like the Myst and Riven games, which are amazing games, but they're not anything like, you know, Trespasser or, you know, or even Doom, you know, like very different kind of game, but, you know, still amazing. So then when I was a kid and found out about this game coming out where, you know, you're in the world of Site B, you know, Isla Sorna, and you're wandering the entire island on your own and encountering dinosaurs, I was like, well, I gotta do that. It's not some side-scrolling, you know, arcade-style game or Nintendo or anything like that.
We try to have some respect for, you know, for the story. And that was important inside of DreamWorks. And, you know, Austin Grossman had invented a narrative style with Doug Church for System Shock. And, like, I wrote a bunch of the engine and physics and AI and stuff and rendering stuff for System Shock. And I think even some music. I wrote the music for another game, another Looking Glass title. So I was doing a lot of stuff, and I watched them develop that narrative technique, which Ken Levine then basically, you know, hijacked and made a career out of. And I think that the narrative technique in Trespasser was Austin's next experiment in that. And it was something I supported greatly. And DreamWorks, amongst the many negative things I just said about DreamWorks from the standpoint of making a game there at that time, they were very supportive of the story. And, you know, Steven arranged for us to have, you know, access to Richard Attenborough, to Dickie, as he was called, and to Minnie Driver and anybody else we'd want. And so I'm grateful for that. And I think that the writing Austin did and the story in Trespasser is, from my view, an absolutely valid and important part of canon for Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the thing that spoke to me the most as I was playing it. I mean, after I was able to get my computer up to speed with having to play it, you know, I got it to work. I worked for that game to make it work on my system. Like, I put the game to work is what I'm saying. You know, it's like I made sure it could work for me. But yeah, so I played it. And yeah, I mean, it was just such a insanely fulfilling treat to just wander around different areas and hear Richard Attenborough's performance of John Hammond.
And I should tell you that the whole time we were recording that, which was at Pinewood in London, he was force feeding us these little pastries that he liked. And so when I hear those quotes, I remember the flavor of these pastries and feeling like I was going to barf because I had too many. That's my memory of it. There was another thing, which is what, you know, so Austin Grossman comes from a literary family. His father was a very, very famous professor of literature, you know, at a big Ivy League school. He was a very important man. And so Austin grew up in this shadow, and his father's not exactly friendly. And he has a sister and a brother. His sister is a mathematical sculptress who is incredibly talented and stupidly brilliant. And his brother is also an author. Lev is a very talented writer. And so Austin, you know, comes from a place of a lot of insecurity, you know, a lot of challenge in a family and a lot of expectations. And so one of the things that I guess maybe the thing that's most important to me, remembering that recording session with Sir Richard Attenborough at Pinewood Studios, you know, where they shot Star Wars, where they shot the Bond films, you name it, right? Was watching Austin go from being very nervous to be directing Richard Attenborough to Austin finding himself and killing it. And the other thing that maybe hasn't been told was that Attenborough was very, very impressed by Austin's writing and was really into it, as you can tell in his performance. And but watching that happen, that's the kind of experience that I wanted for the Trespasser team, right? And so it failed almost everywhere, but there were bright spots. And seeing Austin be in his proper place, the place that his level of talent accords him, of directing Richard Attenborough and having a great performance, was awesome. That and the feeling of being overstuffed with pastries.
Yeah, no, that's got to have been a unforgettable experience for the both of you. I mean, something that is you know, such a unique and special presence of Richard Attenborough. I mean, personally, I feel like he expanded upon, you know, Austin expanded upon his role in the films way beyond what was even on the screen. Like, he just kind of went into these directions, you know, beyond the novel too, because the novel has a very different version of John Hamm, and, you know, it's kind of like an asshole. So this is like so much depth that he added to the film version of his character.
I mean, look, make no mistake about it. Austin is an extremely brilliant man and a very soulful guy. And that's exactly what you should expect from Austin. And you should go buy his books. They're like that. We also there, you know, arranging everything was my great friend who's the assistant producer at the time, Brady Bell, who now runs Magic the Gathering. So it was a really good group of people, I have to say.
Then he produced the strategy guide as well for mini games, right?
Yeah, no, he did. And, you know, he's another really brilliant guy. And again, this is why I feel so bad about dragging everybody through hell.
It's crazy that it happened that way, because as a kid, you know, I had no idea that it was even this badly received at the time. Like, yeah, I had internet access, but all I cared about was living on Isla Sorda, basically. Was being able to go through and, you know, and just hitting all those, you know, vocal points for Richard Attenborough and hearing the amazing music score by Bill Brown. I have to give that a shout out. I mean, he was tasked with an impossible task of following up John Williams. I mean, for a video game.
Well, I know I got to tell you something about that, which was that at the time, Bill Brown, and I've seen him interview lately, and he's different, but at the time, he was a pretty arrogant guy. And he was like, oh, yeah, anybody could cop Williams. I got it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's hilarious. But he did it, and that was great. But and you know, now being older, I think that at the time I was like, oh shit, you know, should I disrespect John Williams? Is John Williams a hack? And now, in the fullness of time, I recognize that when some young guy says that, it's because the influence of John Williams as an artist is so extraordinary that it's in your ear all the time. And of course, it's easy to cop, because he changed the way you think about music. And in fact, what Bill Brown thought was like a slight or an arrogant statement was the ultimate compliment, if you think about it properly. So anyway, there you go. So that's that's Trespasser. How fucked up is that? I will say that, you know, I had mentioned earlier that this was the end of print journalism for games. And it was sort of this turning point. But there was a pivotal thing that happened after Trespasser, which is that I went to work for Microsoft, which is its own story. And I had to go for professional reasons, because I was in charge of like graphics for Windows. I had to go to the Game Developers Conference, and I, you know, pretended like it was fine. And I went and I got a hotel room, and I stayed in the hotel room. I was afraid to go to the conference. And Johnny Wilson, who at that time was the editor and I think became the publisher of Computer Gaming World, for a few years was easily the most influential guy in games journalism, or one of them. And he basically, I think he sent me an email or called me, and he said, you have to come meet with me. Come meet with me at the, you know, CGW booth or whatever the publisher was, right? And I went over there, and it was sort of after hours, and I snuck in, and I was super, super nervous. And it was like one of those two-level booths, and he was up on the top. And he sat with me, and he looked at my face, and I'm gonna get weepy right now remembering this, but he was a very gruff guy, and he was very harsh in his criticism of games that weren't making it. But he was like, but like a journalist, not like an asshole, right? Like a Wall Street Journal reporter or like a Times reporter. And he saw me and you know, and he's sort of represented this figure of terror for a long time. And he took my hands and looked into my eyes, and he said, keep making games. You need to keep making games. And I lost it. And that was a big deal. And that's a lot of what gave me the confidence to go on and you know, try to do something at Microsoft.
Oh, that's great. To have that extra push always helps.
Yeah. Yeah.